Welcome to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP, the federal leader in retirement planning seminars. Join NITP this morning for an hour of plain talk on planning your future. You've got questions, they've got answers.
Welcome to For Your Benefit. We're here this morning to do a couple things different. First of all, let's introduce our, almost a guest, co-host Tammy Flanagan. Good morning, Tammy.
Good morning, Bob.
Good to have you. And Bob Bronstein. Bob, you there?
I am here.
Great. Bob is off-site in New York City, right?
I actually was in New York City yesterday, back in Florida today.
Okay.
Is it sunny down there, Bob?
It's gorgeous.
As usual.
73 and beautiful.
Well, save me a spot.
I will.
All righty. What we're going to do different... we're going to turn the mics on today and let y'all ask us questions, but we'll just start off with some things, I think. First of all, we should say happy birthday to Ann Vincent. Ann is the Director of Business Development at NITP and been around probably as long as Tammy and I almost. Huh?
Just about one of the originals,
yeah,
almost.
Yeah. I think maybe I'm the longest, and
well,
Ann fits
are,
in there,
yeah,
somewhere, and then Tammy, you're right behind it, and Bob is ever charging.
That's right. Happy birthday, Ann.
Yeah, Ann, happy birthday, too, from all of us.
Yes, happy birthday, Ann, and Andrew says the same. All right, Andrew is our fine engineer. Anyway, one thing that we should mention, our friends at NARF, National Association of Active and Retired Federal Employees, reminded us that this week is, what is it? Government Employees...
Public Service Recognition Week.
Yes, and... we should just be aware of that and thank them for the fine services that they provide. And thank you, NARF, for reminding us of that. And then there was another, we have emails. What am I sitting here stumbling about? We have three emails already when we opened up the floodgates. And the floodgates were followed by three emails. But... give us time to answer these three, and then start calling, 202-465-3080, 202-465-3080. Now, your questions can range from anything you want them to be. Benefits, of course, because you got two of the best on the line, and I'll try to cover with the tax, finance, and moderate legal. Alrighty. So the first email that we have is I think that's right up Tammy's and Bob's alley. What's the question here? Because I read it, and I'm anxious to hear the answer.
Well, I'll read the question. I think Bob did some research on this just to make sure we were given the correct answer, because this is something a little bit off the beaten track, but it actually does affect quite a few people. So here is the basis for the question. I think it's from a woman, I think. But anyway, he or she says, I resigned this year. She didn't retire. She just resigned. But she was eligible for an immediate retirement under MRA plus 10. That means that she's a FERS employee. She's got the age for retirement, but she doesn't have the service. So she has more than 10 years and less than 30. So she's eligible for this reduced benefit, but she didn't take it because she just resigned. She's postponing the receipt. So she says, I will postpone commencement of it until I reach age 62, thereby avoiding the permanent annuity reduction for having less than the required years of service. I'm also eligible to reinstate FEHB health insurance upon the commencement of my FERS annuity at age 62. And so therefore she has two questions. So it's true, like when you postpone the MRA plus 10, you can reinstate your health and your life insurance as if you had just retired. So that's all correct. So now she says she's bored, but she has two questions. First of all, or he, I'm not sure. But anyway, she says, if I take a new federal job, will I have to wait three more years once again to vest in the TSP in order to be able to keep my additional agency matching funds that I acquire due to my new employment? Or will I remain invested based on my prior 10 years of federal service? So, Bob, what did we find out the answer to that was?
It's a continuation of her service. It's as if she resigned, and she's already, what I found out is that she's technically already vested, and there should be no additional vesting period, and everything just continues as if she never left.
That's right. Yeah, there's one vesting period a life, so you're good. So he or she will keep the money that whatever they put in, whatever the government matches in the thrift. Okay, then there's part two, another question that says, could taking a new federal job for less than 5 years of reemployment impact my current eligibility to reinstate the health insurance upon starting my retirement annuity at age 62? Because there is a five-year test. And for that, Bob, she's already met the five-year test, so she wouldn't have to work another five. Isn't that right?
Absolutely correct. I mean, technically, if she never came back to work, as long as she had the five when she left, when she resigned, but was otherwise eligible for that immediate annuity under MRI plus 10, in essence, OPM would look at that and allow her to reactivate just based on meeting the five-year test when she originally left federal service.
Yeah, so he or she is in good shape then. They can decide if they want to, if they can get rehired and come back to work, then they can add some more service to what they had already, and then maybe even work until age 62 to start benefits immediately.
You know, what's interesting too, Tammy, and you and I sort of traded some emails on this, is typically when people leave the government as retirees, which she's technically not doing, if they came back to work, they would in most cases be reemployed annuitants, and without a dual comp waiver would be, you know, having their salary reduced by their annuity, but then they could again get additional service, start contributing to TSP, et cetera, and so forth. In this case, that's not really even happening. I mean, she would come back to work before her annuity technically started, so for all intents and purposes, she's not a reemployed annuitant, she's an employee.
Right.
And there would be no need to worry about supplemental annuities, redetermined annuities. It's all really part of the same initial appointment.
Right. I don't know if you find this when you teach seminars or when you follow up with people after they retire, but have you found that there's not that many federal employees who come back to service after retirement, or do you think it's the opposite, that employees retire and then they have second thoughts like this person's having and decides to come back? Do you think it's a common thing or not so common?
Well, you know, it's interesting. It was common for me during a period about 10 or 11 years ago when TSA was being stood up, and the people who were coming back, largely federal security directors and their direct reports at airports, were being brought back with rare skills. So they were getting those dual compensation waivers and were able to receive full salary and their annuities. But of course, these folks were not being considered employees, were not able to contribute to TSP, and any additional service they had was never going to be part of their benefit. I don't see it that often.
Right.
For the most part, people just really don't want to work for what they perceive to be less money. The majority of them are getting the hint that, yeah, I can come back to work for the government, but I need some sort of a pass-through organization so that there's not a direct relationship with me and the agency. I'm not a reemployed annuitant. I'm not under a personal services contract, which enables me to get my full annuity benefit as well as any salary I get, which, albeit from the government, is technically coming through another company that's paying me.
Right. I think these dual compensation waivers and the prospect of phased retirement is really re-energizing federal employees who have retired to thinking about coming back at least part-time or on a limited basis. So I think that's good in a way.
I agree.
Another question, Bob?
Okay. Well, this one-sentence question probably could take up
a whole hour.
Yeah. This is a very good question, and it's I believe he's a fan of the show. He emails us frequently. And the question is, now get this. This is one sentence. I have $500,000 in my TSP, and I was wondering if I should use the 4% withdrawal approach or use the 4% withdrawal approach, but setting aside half of the TSP, and then when interest rates rise to 4.5% by the MetLife annuity. Now that's just a lot of answers to that. So let's just let's
first
slice
of all, what's the 4% rule?
Okay, let's slice and dice.
Please.
I was wondering if I should use the 4% withdrawal approach. Okay, let's just zero in on that. What is the 4%? For a number of years ago, I won't say years ago, maybe 10, 15 years ago, there was a study done by somebody in the 60s, an astute financial planner, and took into consideration all the different 10, 20, 30, 40-year periods that somebody might live after retirement, and if they had their money in stocks as well as bonds, that they could take 4% out each year and increase that by whatever the inflation was, and it would last them for 30 years. So that's kind of the derivation of the 4% rule. Now, at the time that it was done, while 100% accurate, things have changed an awful lot in the past 20 years. We've had boom and a real bad bust. And if somebody followed the 4% rule, they might be sitting here today with the same amount that they had 10 years ago if they hadn't touched it. I think TSB has gathered up all that it lost when we hit the skids in 2008. But that's nice. But if somebody's withdrawing money during that period of time, they have less money to compound and grow for future use. So the 4% rule with the uptick in inflation may not be what it once was, depending on your retirement age. That's the other variable here. I believe the emailer is, I'm going to call him young. I believe he's around 55. Okay, so he's got a longer period of time for that money to last than somebody at 65, 68, or 62. So the 4% rule, if we could see into the future, none of us would be on air. We'd be in front of the stock market. But if you were to look into the future, I don't know that it's going to be what it was when the 4% rule was done. So I'd probably skinny that down to 3% and then even watch it. But it begs the other question. This is why I say this is such a loaded question. How much do you need? I'm not asking the emailer. That's too personal. But 4% of X is going to be a certain amount. Will that cover one's needs?
Or is it more than you need? Because you forget, you know, a lot of times we lose sight of the fact we have two other annuities coming from possibly Social Security and your government pension.
Right.
So that might be enough to cover your living expenses right there. So your TSP could be for pecking at, if you will, you know, as needs come up. So you don't necessarily want to lock into a set distribution if you don't need the money.
Bullseye. So I think it's usually the reverse. How much do I need? And if, like Tammy mentions, if two of my three-legged stool are coming, I don't know that I need to touch the TSP until they make me take it out at 70, and that's kind of set up for a long period of withdrawals as well. So I'm not so sure I'd want to go with the 4% unless I really needed it.
But that second part where he said, what if I took part of it and bought the annuity and the other part of it, you know, use some type of a strategic withdrawal option, that annuity option within the thrift does create a source of income that you can rely on. So if you were short, let's say, $1,000 a month from your needed expenses, then possibly an annuity would give you that sense of security. But there's probably other things you could do as well.
That's true. That's in today's thinking, you have to watch your annuities, the fees, but the thrift annuity is extremely efficient and not that fee sensitive.
Just one comment on those annuities right now. I believe interest rates are pretty low.
I think they're all-time low, aren't they?
See, if you lock one of those in now and inflation starts to uptick, which it's likely to do, I mean, then you're kind of stuck. You really have no flexibility because once you buy one of those, you can't change them.
That's true. And if the inflation or if the interest rate index right now is like 1.75%, that's locked in for the life of the annuity, as Bob B. just said. So this may not be the best time to use that strategy, but maybe wait a few years and see what happens.
That's how loaded this question is, mm-hmm. because he ends the question for when the annuity interest rate hits 4.5%. So as Tammy and Bob have mentioned, well, right now the interest rates are low. They're not anywhere near 4.5. It'd be nice if you could put the half away, but what's the half going to do? So you'd have to make some mathematical calculation as to what the 4% would be. Because you can name what you want mm-hmm. as a monthly distribution, and the other half just kind of stays invested wherever it may be invested. So that's the tough part. So when is it coming up to 4.5? But I don't mean to sound like a negative person here, but if interest rates go down, stock market has a different reaction. Excuse me. When interest rates go up, the stock market goes down, generally speaking. It's not a guarantee, but if we went from, like Tammy and Bob were saying, a very low interest rate environment to 4.5 quickly, which I don't think that would happen, but if it did go quickly, then the market's going to take a bit of a pounding so that the pie, if you will, inside the other half is going to diminish. So you got a lot going.
But that's the good news, though, because with the thrift savings plan, you do have options, so you're not locked into all or nothing. You can split it up where you take a lump sum payment, maybe to pay off some bills or take a vacation. You can take a monthly distribution, and you can use some to buy an annuity. So you don't have to do all with everything. And I think that's what this writer is alluding to, too, that maybe it's best if I kind of split the difference and do some as an annuity and maybe do some as a monthly distribution.
Yeah. And actually, you could have a little bit of the best of both worlds. And one of the monthly distribution options one has, there are two. One is to use an automatic table, and another one is where you're in the driver's seat and you tell them what you want. Mm-hmm. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, Bob and Tammy, but the minimum amount that you would have to take out of the thrift if you elected your own monthly distribution is $25 a month.
That's right.
That's correct.
Okay, so if you kept it very low, what's nice about it, you're not locked in because once a year, you can change your mind. Mm-hmm. And so this way you could kind of wait on the side of the road until your bus comes.
not to mention the fact also that when you do that monthly distribution, like you said, Bob, everything's in play. You can invest it in the same manner that you've been doing. You can use outside counsel for doing that. But then by and large, if you know, something happens to you, that money is still available for either inheritance by a spouse who takes over the TSP program, or it might be on a TSP-3. Whereas money that tends to be that's locked up in a MetLife annuity, unfortunately, is out of play for you. It's no longer yours. You don't really have any access to it.
Right. And the more features you add to the annuity to protect it, the less your monthly payment's going to be. So it's
kind
of a catch-22.
Bottom line goes down. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Okay, now we're going to answer the email. Our same person has another really good email in just a second, but let's introduce the phone number again because this is your show. Call us. Benefit questions, finance questions, tax questions. 202-465-3080. 202-465-3080. Alrighty, so the second email from the same person says, I believe it would be a good idea to transfer my TSP to Vanguard since they have a better selection of funds. Other companies do. Let's say Vanguard does for the sake of discussion, but other companies have large selections as well. And I'm very interested in the Vanguard Healthcare Fund. With record number of baby boomers retiring, it is very disappointing that the TSP does not add a well-diversified health care plan. But remember now, anything the TSP does has to be approved by Congress. So a number of years ago, the gold bugs wanted a gold fund, and then they wanted the real estate fund, and probably
whatever the hot ticket is,
right.
You know, people want that. And the TSP's take on that is the fact if we add too many funds, it's going to complicate it for the average everyday employee and muddle the system so much that we get paralyzed from all the confusion. So the TSP doesn't tend to follow those trends, but instead really looks at broad, diversified accounts and really is cautious about adding things like that. So I don't know that you'll see that anytime soon.
But
not to mention, it would raise the administrative costs considerably, too, to add a lot of new items and instruments and...
And they're directed by Congress to keep an eye on that bottom line, which they've done an excellent job.
But if the emailer, like you said, wanted to transfer some out of the TSP and put it into the Vanguard General Fund, but in specific by the Vanguard Healthcare, I mean, he couldn't pick a better fund for one that's torn the cover off the ball, as they say.
No, that's only if he's retired. I think this is still an employee.
Yeah. But when this thing first started out in 1984, if you were to look at it on a chart, it almost is a direct line up with very few dips. Now, why so? I mean, hindsight, as they say, is 2020, but the healthcare people were warming up to the idea there's an awful lot of baby boomers heading into healthcare needs. And is this fund at its max? I don't know. If I was so smart, I wouldn't be doing the show.
Yeah, plus I think that's a very volatile area because we don't really know. We have this country has to do something to accommodate all these aging baby boomers, which I think all of us in this phone call are part of that generation. So, you know, we don't know if we're heading towards national health care, more of, you know, what we started with Obamacare. We don't know if there's going to be more competition within the commercial market. So I think that's a risky avenue to follow, not knowing the future.
I deal with a number of medical practices on the other side of my life, and they're very anxious about the affordable health care and what it's going to do to their practice. So in other words, if the feds put a squeeze on reimbursements, this health care fund still might be good, but it might not be as good as it was. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Yeah, and Bob and I, remember Bob Bronstein, we were following last week some proposed legislation and hear us proposed that could do what was that again? Do you remember what we were talking about?
I'm trying to remember right now.
It was that bill that's by, let's see, what, Congressman Camp, Representative Dave Camp out of Michigan. And he proposed to dismantle the FEHBP and put everybody under the Affordable Health Care Act, which I don't know that that's going to go anywhere. There's a lot of opposition from NARF and other groups that represent federal employees, but that's how volatile this is. You know, we don't know what's going to happen.
In other words, yeah, federal employees would be compelled to use the exchanges as opposed to being covered by the FEHB umbrella. I agree with you. I don't think that really has a huge chance to go forward.
Mm-mm.
It seems more like I was more politically motivated than not.
Not anything. But
yeah, and you also mentioned, Tammy, I think it's true, there are actually efforts on the other side to try to improve FEHB and keep it, you know, even more robust than it is. So it's kind of hard to know, you know, what the item du jour is in Congress with respect to federal employees' health benefits.
Right. I don't think employees always understand that Congress is sometimes looking out for your best interest, because on April 11th, there was a subcommittee hearing where Congress invited people from the healthcare industry and NARF and OPM and a bunch of people who understand what's going on with FEHB to sit around and really look at it. The fact is, federal employees' health benefits still a good value for federal employees. So they were listening to all that testimony, and hopefully we'll take that into consideration as they move forward with any type of remodeling of FEHB that might be proposed.
All righty, it's time for a call. No one needs to be shy. We never use names, never talk about agencies, so you're not going to be transparent to anybody, including us. 202-465-3080. And again, any question you want, benefits, finance, tax, Social Security.
You can email us, except for the fact we don't get your emails until after the show. So we would either respond via email or maybe address it next week on the show. So we'd prefer you to call in. We're pretty friendly, usually.
Well, I think we're friendly, and we're very quick to respond to the emails as well. And we're the only ones doing it, to the best of my knowledge, in the country. So anyway, if nobody's the phone lines aren't being lit, are they, Andrew? Not yet. Okay, so Tammy's got something.
Yeah, I wanted to just give an update, because this just came out, I guess, over the weekend or maybe late last week. This is the processing of retirement claims. A lot of employees who are near retirement or planning to retire this year are a little fearful about what they hear of how long it's going to take to process their claim. So in other words, if you retire, let's say May 31st, that's your last day on the job, you might wait until the end of this year, maybe even early next year, before you're finalized in the retired status. But during that transition, you'll be receiving what they call interim retirement checks. So you're not going to be left, you know, penniless for the next 6 to 8 months, but you are going to be in this limbo period, not sure of how things are going to work out. So once a month, OPM does publish on their website at opm.gov the projected and actual new claims processed and the current inventory. So at the end of April, April 30th, OPM had expected to receive 8,000 new claims. And in fact, they received a little over 7,000. So they were pretty much on target for their expectations for this month. And they were actually processing way more claims than they received. They got 13,582 claims off their desk. So that leaves them with an inventory of pending claims of a little over 30,000. And that's actually, it sounds like tremendous, and it is a lot of unprocessed claims, but it's half of what they had January of 2012. So whatever they have done at OPM to make strides in making the process more efficient, getting more employees on the job, and also kind of communicating better with agencies of how to submit a claim so it's better prepared for processing, is working. So hopefully they're on track to reduce that backlog of claims to around 10,000 is what they're hoping to do by July. So if that does happen, that could get that waiting period from 6 to 8 months, hopefully down to 2 to 3 months as what it used to be. And until we get an electronic processing system in place, you'll probably not see it become instantaneous until that happens. But at least it won't cause that great delay like we were seeing last year. Oh, and the other thing that's coming up is later this week on May 9th, the House Oversight and Government Reform Subcommittee on the Federal Workforce is going to hold a meeting in Congress, and they're inviting, again, OPM to come in along with NARF and I guess some other people to discuss this retirement processing backlog and see what progress has been made and make sure that OPM is on target for reducing that backlog so employees who retire don't have to wait months upon months to get their first check.
Well, good. Yeah. May I pretend I'm a federal employee and I just read the GovExec article this past Friday, Tammy?
Sure.
You're famous. best dates to retire in the year and best dates not to retire in
the
year.
Well, that's thanks to Mike Causey. I've got claim to fame. He brought that up, what, about 25 years ago about the best date to retire and enlisted my help in helping him figure it out. So.
Okay, but it's in this past Friday, May 2nd, right?
3rd, I think.
3rd, okay. Mm-hmm. Article. And so let me ask you a question. In your article, you actually use two calendars, I believe, and one is kind of says, okay, this would be attractive for you if you're FERS, this would be attractive for you if you're CSRS, but on the other calendar, doesn't it do the other and say you might want to think twice about going out first few days if you're CSRS in this month? And
well, there's just some text, you know, some things to think about, and I just point out some dates that are kind of like the trifecta, where it's the end of the month, it's also the end of a leave period, it's, you know, a date when your retirement's going to start the next date. So there are some months that happen to end just nicely like that. And if you're under the CSRS system, you can retire on the first, second, or third day of a month, and you would still get a retirement check for that month. So for civil service employees, you have a little grace period every month of 3 days, which sometimes will get you to the end of the week, which is also possibly the end of a leave period some weeks. So I point out what those dates are, because if you retire, let's say you were to retire today on May 6th, you say, man, I've learned enough from that radio show. I'm just going to put in my papers and retire this afternoon. So if somebody retired under civil service or FERS this afternoon on May 6th, they would get paid through today, but they wouldn't get a retirement check until the month of June, and that wouldn't come until July 1st. So the rest of May would be uncompensated. They wouldn't get a paycheck because they left today. They wouldn't get a retirement check because it doesn't start till the first of next month. So we always, you know, Bob Bronstein can relate to this with me as well. You know, we always look at the end of the month as the starting point for picking a date. Right, Bob?
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, there's one kind of an exception this year, though. It's interesting. Depending upon how long your service is, if you're a FERS employee, let's say you're highly compensated, and maybe you only have 20 years of service, so your annuity is really not going to be representative of your salary. The leave year, I believe, this year ends, correct me if I'm wrong, Tammy, around January 12th.
Right, the 11th, so, I think, but yeah, right around there. Mm-hmm.
So if one was able to work through the leave year at their current salary and retire on the 11th, they would still be able to take that big lump sum annual leave payment, which is the ceiling they carried over plus all of their user lose, be paid through the 12th or the 11th at a fairly high rate, and mathematically that might work out better than leaving December 31st, not getting that additional 12 days of pay, but having the entire month compensated as an annuitant.
And that would allow them to get full credit for their sick leave, which they wouldn't get if they left December 31st. So yeah, we talk about that too. So yeah, those are all things to think about. And it's not that complicated once you know the rules. But I make it even easier by publishing the calendar.
Yeah, so. And it's in color, so yeah. I can understand it. All right, we have a caller.
Great article.
Thanks, Bob.
Good morning.
Good morning.
All righty, fire away.
Well, first of all, none of you are allowed to ever retire because you are an awesome resource, and thank you very much for being out there for all of us. It's awesome.
Well, thank you.
You know, one day we're going to practice what we preach, but not yet.
Not ready.
Do you have any recommendations for if you should just have investments outside of your government retirement, or do you think what we have, if you're a FERS retiree or a FERS employee and you use TSP and, you know, perhaps Social Security will be around in the future and so forth for our three-legged stool? Do you have any recommendations for, do we need to have investments outside of what we have as far as our government retirement to last us through our later years?
You mean if you're already maxing out the thrift or to do instead of the thrift?
If you're already maxing out the thrift.
So you're putting in what you can in the thrift, what you're allowed to put in, plus you have your, are you CSRS or FERS?
FERS.
FERS. So you have your FERS basic retirement benefit, and then you're paying into Social Security. So my opinion, I'll let Bob's going to talk, both Bobs will talk about this, but my opinion is if you're doing all of that and you've done it consistently throughout your career, do the math and do some goal setting, and I think you might find out you're better off than you think, because between those three benefit or those three sources of retirement income, you might be able to replace enough of your pre-retirement income to retire comfortably. But if that's not the case, then I think additional savings might be in order. But do the math first to find out where you are.
And I'd, good point. And I'd go, one step further on the finance side. If you have the cash flow to do it and you're not inclined just to spend it, and you'd say, gee, I'd like to save and maybe I'll spend a little bit, then everything shouldn't necessarily be tax deferred. I know that sounds odd coming from an accountant, but everything doesn't necessarily, but certainly you can put money into an IRA. Now, whether that's a Roth IRA will be dependent upon your total income, and it's fairly significant before you can't put money into a Roth IRA, but you can always put money into a traditional IRA. It doesn't make any difference what your income is. And there's even a way to get money, and it's beyond today's show, and we've done it before, you can get money into a Roth IRA even if your income is in excess of the max by doing what's called a backdoor, it sounds awful, doesn't it, Roth IRA, and still get the money in there. But with regards to a Roth IRA, depending upon your filing status, if you're single and your total income on your return exceeds $127,000, you cannot put money into a Roth for that year. Or if you're married, it's $188,000. Now, that's a lot of money, but two-income family, it could be. Right. But there's still ways to get it into the Roth IRA, so it's an attractive investment for investing as well as taxes, because if you never pay taxes on, how good is that? Yeah. I hope that helped you.
What about Bob B? I bet he has an opinion too.
Well, one of the things that I wanted to mention too is that, remember, the IRS elected deferral limit, $17,500. I mean, once you've exhausted that, and assuming you've done that through TSP contributions, I mean, in essence, you really... And of course, you have $5,500 catch-up if you reach the age of 50 or will this year. Outside of that $23,000, if you're looking to tax-defer additional income, correct me if I'm wrong, Bob, you really can't do that. You can still do
another IRA, right, Bob, in addition to maxing out your thrift.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
But can you get additional tax-deferred income into that IRA, or are you still limited to the $23,000?
Well, let's say that you were at the $23,000 with the thrift, and you wanted to put another $6,500 into an IRA. You could,
but it would be after tax.
Too. Most likely, you're not going to deduct it because your income is above the ceiling if you're putting that kind of money away into the thrift. The Roth would be the ideal one, but there's income ceilings on that.
The other thing I just wanted to mention, which you know sort of skirts the investment issue, because I think TSP tends to mirror the market pretty well. One of the things that I found about having money outside is that, albeit with higher fees, you gain greater flexibility in how you can pull the money out and use it. I mean, you can start and stop payment streams, pull a chunk here, pull a chunk there. The brokerage or wherever you have your money invested will send the amount to IRS that's necessary, and you just have more flexibility. So a lot of people, you know, who in government who reach that magic 59 and a half and do an age-based withdrawal are looking for that kind of flexibility. Even people who retire might take some money, roll it into a brokerage, gain additional granularity in investment, but equally important, a lot more flexibility to use the money beyond which TSP allows you to do. TSP is kind of limited. They keep it simple. They keep it inexpensive. But with that, you know, the other side of that is higher fees.
Right. You have to balance the pros and cons of both.
Did that answer your question, caller?
It did quite a bit. But I'm a younger Fed, actually, and I'm looking to retire as soon as I can take advantage of, you know.
Yeah, I'd say that, you know, when you're mid-career or early career employee, then start doing some projecting of, you know, you have those statements that come from Social Security and, you know, that can change, but I think you'll still get something there. And you have your FERS retirement benefit, which if you work 30 years or more than 30 years, you can expect about a third of your income to be replaced just with that check. So then start to figure out how much additional money do I have to save in order to make it comfortable. So you don't want to live uncomfortably now so that, you know, you're have too much money in retirement, but on the other hand, you know, save enough. So I wouldn't panic that you're not able to do it with just your government pension. But, you know, some people who didn't save early in their life, they try to make up for lost time by those additional IRA investments and those kind of things. But I always say start early and save consistently. You'll be okay.
Okay. And one more point, and then we got another caller. If you're anxious to retire or, excuse me, leave your current situation, that means you're going to have a longer period of time in retirement. So that money in your retirement accounts has got to be pretty strong to carry the longer term.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Well, good luck to you. Thanks for calling.
Thanks for calling.
Good luck.
Bye-bye.
Bye now. All righty. We got another caller. Good morning.
Hi.
Hi.
I want to thank both Bobs and Tammy for answering all our questions. This is wonderful.
Thank you.
You had spoken earlier about the TSP monthly distribution and about changing it any time once a year. Is there a certain date, like is it the 1st of January? Say I was retired and I decided to take a monthly distribution.
You want to take that, Bob, or you want
it's
me to
December.
It's the end of the year.
The end of the year.
Right.
For the upcoming calendar year. So the good news is you can change it once a year, and I'd say that that's good. The bad news is you can only change it once a year. So if you were to say, okay, I need X dollars, but something comes up in middle part of the year, you might not be able to satisfy that demand for the money.
Yeah, it's not like a bank account. You can't just take it out in June.
Right.
Yeah.
But
now, what if somebody retired, let's just say they retired June 30th, and they started a payment stream? Now, in December, they'd be able to change that, correct?
For the next year. That's right.
That's
right.
So
yeah, once you start that once a year, they let you change it.
Mm-hmm.
And,
so is it like December 30th or?
Well, they'll send you a form at the end of the year saying, this is how much you've scheduled to take out. Would you like to change it in January?
Okay.
So you'll receive that somewhere. I don't know if it's on the same date at the end of the year, but it's towards the end of the year in December sometime.
And I'm going to add one comment, but this is not law. But we've had the thrift folks on twice a year for as many years as I can remember. They're nice enough to come. We're talking about the director and the director of external affairs and the tax counsel as well. And there's been some feeling that they would like to see it twice a year. But remember, it's got to go through Congress. So
And the board has to approve it.
So until then, now the people that were on the show were not trying to play their comments off against the board of Congress. They were just saying, we're looking at this.
Mm-hmm.
So that it would give you then that flexibility that if you made a decision in December, you're not shackled with it for the entire year. I would imagine it'd be June, but don't quote me on that.
Mm-hmm.
So that might be coming. But it has not been coming for a couple of years.
Or like Bob Bronstein alluded to, you could take some of your TSP, you can do a partial distribution of some of it and move it to an IRA so that money's available for you to take out as you need it, but then leave the bulk of your money in the TSP to take advantage of the low administrative expenses and maybe the monthly payment if that's what you're interested in. So you do have some flexibility to move some out.
Okay, and there's one other quick question in regards to if I were to do this when I retire, do I have to do a special W-4 for them to take taxes out for that? Or when I do the W-4 for my regular annuity, does that cover both, or how does that work?
You'll be dealing with two different agencies because OPM is going to handle your regular retirement, whether it's CSRS or FERS, so you will let them know what kind of tax withholding. But with the thrift plan, Bob,
the thrift plan actually works on a different assumption, and it's a very accurate one. It's 20% whatever you take out.
Depending on the way you do the income stream, though.
Right. But the point being is that it can't, where the annuity, you kind of know what it's going to be every month, so exemptions mean more. So the flat 20% based on what you're going to get. Is it? But please remember this, they don't take state taxes out in that case.
Okay. Just the federal, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks
Thank
for
you.
Calling.
Thanks. Bye.
All righty. Bye-bye. Got another caller, Andrew? No? Okay.
But that's the other...
Bob, you still there?
Yeah, still here.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't know what that buzzing was.
Let me correct me if I'm wrong, Bob. That 20% that with respect to TSP, it was my understanding that if it appears as though you were going to exhaust your account within 10 years, they automatically withheld that. Otherwise, it was pretty much up to you to make sure they were holding enough out, or you could even go the route of estimated taxes once a quarter.
That's right too. They do have that stipulation. If your payments will be exhausted less than 10 years, then you're right, 20%. But other right. longer than that, or the annuity option, you can do withholding as
based
like
on right. the W4P.
Yeah, and the other thing too with what she said was brought to mind that when you retire, we were talking about the backlog and the processing at OPM to get your first civil service or FERS check. While you're waiting for that finalization of your claim, you can have federal tax withholding, but they don't withhold state income tax from those interim checks. So I think, Bob, you've talked about this before, about how people can make sure they don't fall short of paying their state income tax while they're waiting.
Picture that. If it takes 3 months, okay,
or six
three.
Months.
If it takes 6 months and you're in a high tax state, you can get awfully far behind. So how do you rectify that? Knowing that you're going to retire, you might up your withholding while still on the job, assuming the same calendar year now. Or when the annuity does kick in, then you really jack your withholding up to make up for that dry period. But if you retire mid-year, you might not have either one of those luxuries.
I have another solution.
Or estimated taxes. Now, estimated taxes require that you save the money and pay to the taxing authority once a quarter. Truth of the matter is you could pay them every month if you wanted to. You just file the same form for the particular quarter. So it isn't like you can't pay the taxes, but people have an aversion to estimated taxes, which they shouldn't, but it requires discipline, and it's just hard to write a check like that. Bob, I'm sorry.
Yeah, it's okay. My solution is move to Florida.
That's right. No state income tax, along with what? How many other states are in that same boat?
There's a total of 9. I think New Hampshire's among them, Tennessee. I can't recite them all.
I have them.
Bob carries that with him everywhere he goes.
okay.
There are a number of states also that don't tax
the annuity.
Federal annuities and Social Security.
I have them too. Okay, so states that don't have a state income tax, Alaska, I don't think we're going to have a rush to retire in Alaska, but Alaska, Florida, Bob being the ambassador of Florida, Nevada, New Hampshire. Now, they have a dividends and interest tax, but they don't have an income tax per se. South Dakota, Tennessee, same thing, dividends and interest. Taxes, nothing. Washington State, nothing. Wyoming, nothing. States that don't tax the federal annuity. It says civil service annuity, but what it means, were you a civil servant? Alabama, Hawaii, Illinois, Kansas, probably Kentucky. There's a hitch to that. Louisiana, Massachusetts, Michigan, hitch to that. Mississippi, New York, North Carolina.
Hitch to North Carolina too.
Oregon, hitch to that. Pennsylvania and Tennessee. Now, Pennsylvania is interesting because they don't tax the thrift distribution either, nor do they tax IRAs.
Yeah, but as a lot of people say, and I think, Bob, you've said this too, don't make your retirement move plan based just on that, because they got to collect taxes somewhere, right?
Exactly. That's why we don't have a mass migration to Alaska.
That's why I say live on the border. Like, live between two states. One exempts your retirement from tax, and one that has a low sales tax. And then you can shop in one and live in the other.
Mike Causey has a story that he tells of, I don't know whether it was a colleague or a friend, but they moved to Washington State because they didn't have a state income tax, and they moved to the border of, I guess, Oregon that doesn't have a sales tax. And they were that close so that they could do the shopping in Oregon and the living. And,
yeah, but the funny thing was, he said the guy had never visited either state. He just knew about the taxing and thought it would be a great place to live. hope it worked out.
All righty. So there you go. You got hard advice and realistic advice as well. Andrew, nobody's on the line, right? We're 202-465-3080. 202-465-3080. We got another 9 minutes or so, 8.5 minutes. Do yourself a favor. Give us a holler. You're not going to find all three of us on the same show at one time. So
not too often.
No. So what happened? What happened this week in taxes? I don't know. One awful thing came out as a proposal that somebody couldn't have. Now this is an awful lot of money, but it may not be an awful lot of money. $3 million in their retirement account. Okay, so what's in the retirement account? And the answer is, well, certainly it would be money in your thrift. Certainly it would be money in your IRA. Question.
And by the
is,
way, nobody has $3 million in the thrift. So if you don't, no, don't feel bad.
No, no, they don't. But and $3 million is a huge number. But here's a tougher question. I don't know if you all know what present value is, but present value is a determination of if you're going to live a certain number of years and you have an annuity of X, then you're going to collect that much over the years. And what it does is it brings it back in today's terms and said this is how much money you would have set aside into a retirement program to pay that kind of monthly payment for the life expectancy that you might have based on IRS's life expectancies. Now, picture a Fed, FERS, CSRS, doesn't make any difference, but the present value of that annuity, I don't know if that $3 million is in, if that is in the $3 million, and I've asked the people that would know, and they don't know. I'm not so sure Congress knows. It was just thrown out. But if you factored in the present value of that and Social Security and all the other ones, $3 million is still an awful lot of money, but it's not prohibitive. Like Tammy said, there are no $3 million TSP people. Nope. But there are people that work for Uncle that maybe had a pension plan from a prior employer. They may have brought money into the TSP from their prior employer's plan, et cetera, and maybe they came in at a high grade level. It's not so far out of the realm. I don't think the thing is going to pass because the calculation is abhorrent.
But you bring up a good point because I know a lot of people live in fear because they'll read an article or they'll hear something on the news that says if you want to retire comfortably, you've got to have $2 million saved. But that doesn't take into account that you have a government pension that might be worth $1 million or $2 million just, you know, the way it pays out a monthly benefit for the rest of your life. And then on top of that, Social Security has that, like you said, present value to it as well. So if you take those into account, then you still don't need another $2 million on top of that to be able to retire comfortably,
well,
unless you want
well
to take
put.
Trips to Malta every year or wherever you might want to go. But yeah, so I think federal employees don't need to panic as much as you might if you worked in a job that didn't have a pension.
Let me just ask a question on that, Bob. You know, and Tammy, let's just say, you know, one portion of your three-legged stool, that annuity, whether it's FERS or CSRS, let's just arbitrarily say it's $40,000 a year, and that's going to be compounded by COLAs. What would one typically need to have in the bank in principle to generate that level of income?
At a minimum, a million based on that number. Mm-hmm. At a minimum.
Yep.
Right. So, you know, my dad has always told me that even though he doesn't have millions in the bank, he's got an annuity from his military service. He's got a civil service annuity from the 20 years he spent in the government after he left the military service. And mom has a small one. So they consider themselves, despite the fact that they don't have that principal, to be millionaires because the income they have coming in would require millions to generate it.
Absolutely. Yeah, you can't beat that.
All right, I like this upbeat stuff, but we do have a caller with another upbeat question, I'm sure. Good morning.
Good morning. This is Francisco Souza in Arlington, Virginia.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for calling.
Good morning.
One solution to healthcare costs, in my opinion, is for the federal government. For example, I was looking at the situation at the post office. The post office can simplify many problems with healthcare and retirement programs by simply setting up a captive insurance company that will not disturb anything, any contractual arrangements with federal employees, legally speaking.
But doesn't a captive have to have a fair amount of dollars behind it to make it make sense?
No, it does not. I could not explain all that. A captive is a fairly flexible structure. It's not one size fits all. You can pretty much design the captive in kinds of ways. In fact, the requirement is flexible depending on the state. For example, Delaware would be a good place, in my opinion. I guess it's Delaware is a good place for a captive.
That's something.
But that's a problem for federal employees, because we have to have something that works across all the states. And for federal employees, that might be the reason why Congress hasn't gone that route, because we can't stipulate, you know, if you work in this state or that state, you're going to have a different parameter.
I don't mean it's not going to change the relationship between the post office and the employee. That is not changed. It depends. I'm talking about the requirements, funding levels, and things of that sort. But the relationship does not change between employees and the captive. It remains the same way. That is, I don't understand why this is sacred.
I think you should have been on that subcommittee meeting last month with Congress and given them your idea.
It was sacred.
You used your opinions.
It was sacred when it first came out, because they peppered the – when it first came out, it was probably 12 years ago, the concept of captives. And they were concerned that IRS would say no. And they had to offer that in their disclosure package. But they were ahead of the game, because they were right. And it is an acceptable method of insuring, if you will. And it's called captive insurance. It's not a great title, is it? But it appeals especially to business folks, but it could also appeal to healthcare folks. So your comment is accurate, and for those of you that say, "What is a captive?" and Google captive, and they have their own industry association, and actually,
is that a name of a company? Captive?
It's the name of the concept, and it's I don't
you
know.
You got a captive audience.
Call or collect me if I'm real off base here, but it's somewhat like an IRA. Okay, we're getting a high sign from Andrew that we have a minute left. I'm sorry. Any final comments, caller? I hate to...
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
All right, thanks. Thanks for calling.
All righty. Tammy, 1 minute.
I have nothing to add. I think we covered a wide range of topics.
Yes, we did. And captive insurance, too. This is great. Yeah. All right, Bob?
All I want to tell everybody is that, you know, people think I'm not retired, and technically I'm really not, because I'm pensioned with benefits. But for those who are thinking about it in the federal government, who are not yet ready to really, you know, kick back and simply be in that easy chair, being a retired Fed gives you tremendous options to do a lot of things.
Okay, Bob.
You're very marketable.
That's good, Bob. We got
to
say goodbye.
Good talking
bye-bye
to you.
Bye-bye, y'all. Please call us and listen again next week.
You've been listening to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP. Please tune in next Monday at 10 a.m. for a topic solely devoted to you, the federal employee. The show can also be heard 24/7 on federalnewsradio.com. Thanks for listening.